Welcome to Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. Thank you very much. I don't know what week of lockdown this is, but we're still okay.
Yeah, I've lost count. I don't think I've left my flat in weeks, and so it's a very strange world we're living in.
Yeah, indeed.
We are joined by a very special guest this week. Now that we're all sort of locked down, I think we're trying to reach out to all our friends around the world to have them come and talk with us, because it's a strange social, antisocial place we're in. And we're joined this week by Ben Park. And Frank, I think you've had Ben is a former student of yours, isn't that right?
Well, Ben is a friend of mine, but he happens to be a former student as well.
Yes. That's the best time.
Everything I know about history, I learned from Frank's Intellectual History of the American Revolution course, taught in spring of 2010.
Wow,
was it that long ago, Ben? Gosh.
It's been longer than I'd care to admit, yeah.
Yeah, wow. Well, you haven't aged. I can't say that about me. Anyway, yes, I taught Ben when he was in Edinburgh for his MSc a decade ago, and he's gone on to do great things, and we're really, really thrilled to have Ben with us here to talk about his most recent book, but to talk more generally about his experience teaching history, studying U.S. history in the UK. He's somebody who did his master's and PhD in the UK. So Ben's is an old friend and a good friend and a very, very fine historian. He was described recently in the New Yorker as an ambidextrous historian. I'm very interested in that because I know that, Ben's keen to play basketball. So being ambidextrous is a virtue.
That's how I prefer to be called now, Ben Ambidextrous.
So Ben, welcome to the podcast. It's really a great thrill to have you here.
Oh, it's a true honor to join you guys.
So actually, by way of introduction, I mean, you'll be known to many of our listeners, but not all of them. Could tell us about yourself?
Sure. So I received my bachelor's degree in English and history from Brigham Young University, and then I went on to do a master's degree at Edinburgh, historical theology, changed my life, both the city and the education, and then I went on and did another master's and a PhD at Cambridge, deciding to stay in the UK to study America, because that's just what suited me. And my first book was on American Nationalisms, Imagining Union in the Age of Revolutions, which was published by Cambridge University Press. I was the inaugural postdoctoral fellow at the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy at the University of Missouri, and I just finished my fourth year teaching history at Sam Houston State University. And the reason I'm guessing I'm – one of the reasons I'm on is one of my – I just finished a book, Kingdom of Nauvoo, The Rise and Fall of a Religious Empire in the American Frontier, which appeared just a couple months ago in February with the Live Right imprint of W.W. Norton.
Excellent. Well, that's an excellent praise, and congratulations on all you've achieved. If we can unpack some of that. So how did you find studying American history outside of the United States and in the UK in particular? Why did you make that choice?
Yeah, well, I mean, I made the choice because I went into grad school in the middle of not the most recent recession now, but the recession before the current recession, when everything was falling apart and American grad programs were breaking down. And I frankly didn't get into a lot of PhD programs that I applied to, but I had a very smart advisor who said, well, why don't you look broader? And by that, I mean abroad. And so I applied to a number of UK programs. Thankfully, UK programs have later application dates. And I got into Edinburgh, where I studied actually in the Divinity School, theology and history, but I was always a historian at heart. And I loved it from another perspective, both content-wise. Viewing America from the UK lens really helped me get out of the traditional exceptionalist narrative. Being able to talk to other students, other faculty about American history meant being conversant in other fields and other geographies, and not to mention other languages, and that really helped me. But also just the format helped me a lot. The UK graduate programs are a lot more one-on-one intensive with your advisor and doing your research, and that really fit me. By the time I got to graduate school, I already had a kid, I was married, and I was ready to get on with researching, and so that enabled me to get through my all my graduate programs pretty quickly and move on to what was my first book.
Excellent. And then You're at Sam Houston State now, and we were talking a little bit off air before we started. How has your teaching been impacted by the COVID outbreak and the pandemic?
Yeah, like all other universities, we've moved online for the semester. Unlike most universities, we already had a robust online teaching program. In fact, our graduate program in history at Sam Houston is almost primarily online, where we have upwards of 140 graduate students spread out throughout America, most of them teachers who are trying to get a master's degree or master's certificate so they can teach dual credit and AP classes. And so from my first year at Sam Houston, I had to get used to teaching online, mostly at the graduate level, but at least during the summers at the undergraduate level. So when this pandemic happened, thankfully Sam Houston already had the tools and the expertise to jump into online teaching. And as a result, I think we're in a lot better shape than some other programs.
Right. Interesting. David, do you have questions?
Well, I really love the new book. It's an amazing accomplishment, and the fact that you've got two books that have come out in 2 years, that's mind blowing. So congratulations on that.
Well, thank you.
Because one of the things, tell me who you were sort of thinking about for the audience for this book. Because I just, you know, the way my understanding as somebody who as an outsider to Mormon history is it seems to be kind of a closed circle in some ways, and you seem to be trying to speak not only to that circle but to a much broader public.
Sorry. If I can interrupt, Ben, could you just briefly tell our listeners what the book is about first before you do that?
I'm assuring that all our listeners have already read the book, Frank.
And then I'll get into David's excellent question. Kingdom of Nauvoo tells a story of basically a pivotal moment in Mormon history when Joseph Smith, who was a founder of the LDS Mormon tradition in 1830, by 1839, they'd been kicked out of a number of communities and they settle in Illinois. In 1839, they get their own little hamlet of land on a peninsula along the Mississippi River that they rename Nauvoo. And my book kind of tells the story of the rise and fall of the city. It's organized in early 1839, and by 1844, 1845, they have upwards of 20,000 people living in that city, which is one of the most populous urban settlements west of Cleveland, larger than even Chicago at the time. But it's also the story of its fall, because the Mormons, having concluded that the democratic system failed them and the existing structures weren't going to watch their interests, decided that they need to at first redeem the democratic system through a number of experimental methods like block voting. And then when that failed them, they decided to replace the democratic system altogether by establishing a theocracy. This ends up becoming a bloody episode in which those outside of Nauvoo, who were worried that the Mormons were threatening the very democratic experiment they'd come to embrace, forced them out at gunpoint. In 1844, Joseph Smith and his brother were killed while prisoners in a county jail under state protection. And then a couple of years later, all 20,000 of the Mormons were forced out of Nauvoo, most of whom moved westward and settled Utah. So this the book Kingdom of Nauvoo is in many ways a story of democracy in crisis, telling not only the fascinating narrative of this rise and fall, but also what it tells us about American political and religious culture during the antebellum period. Now, I wrote it for a number of reasons. I wanted to get to David's question of audience. There hadn't been a book about Nauvoo written for a non-Mormon audience in over 50 years, which is pretty striking given what I see is Nauvoo's significance in America's religious history. Now, as David mentioned, there's been a lot of works written on Mormonism, but typically in a parochial framework to just understand Mormons, often for a Mormon audience and rarely written for an outside public. But I thought that this story of Nauvoo had a lot more relevance than just for Mormon readers. It had relevance for the broader American story. So I set out to write this book, kind of introducing the American public to what I feel is a unique, potent, and significant, as well as just fascinating period of American history.
So, excellent.
May I just follow up on that? So one of the themes seems to be that they are in some ways that the community there is both representative or sort of the epitome of some kind of trends that are going on in the United States more broadly. But then at the same time, there's sort of a Mormon exceptionalism on the frontier going on simultaneously. I found that sort of that theme really, really interesting in the book.
Well, thank you. That's definitely what I try to play out. Just to use one example of that, in Joseph Smith's final months, he established a new council that they referred to as the Council of 50 or the Kingdom, which in their own words was meant to be a theocratic organization to replace all world governments. Now, of course, that's radical. I argue in the book that it's the most radical political and religious proposal in antebellum America. But I was also struck by the cultural sentiments that they shared with others. I mean, they weren't the only people who argued that America's disestablishment or the separation of church and state had gone too far. There were abolitionists, women suffragists, workers' rights people who were arguing that America had lost her way because she wasn't listening to the divine origins of laws and privileges and rights. Nor were the Mormons the only ones thinking that the American government had run its course and was ready to replace. I mean, we have William Lloyd Garrison burning the Constitution and declaring it a pact with the devil. I try to show that even if the Mormons were an extreme version of these cultural sentiments, they were representative of a lot of what was going on in America at the time.
Yeah.
Ben, the book has been very well received. It's an excellent book, which we can commend to all of our listeners. Has it been received differently in your experience? I know your book tour was cut short by the pandemic, and we might talk about that. But has it been received differently by Mormon and non-Mormon audiences than reviewers?
It's a good question. I think to an extent it's a bit too early to tell for me. I've received generally positive reviews from people, which I think is typically the normal thing that happens early on in a book's reception, and you don't get the very critical in-depth reviews until later. But within the Mormon community, I've seen both an expression of people saying, oh, this is just the same story we've heard over and over again, as well as some people saying that, oh, this is shedding new light on Nauvoo. So in general, I think it's received a positive reception from both Mormon and non-Mormon audiences, but I'm going to be really interested to see going forward if that continues.
And you had access to some materials that previous historians didn't in terms of the minutes of the Council of 50. How did that come about?
So, and in reality, that's what sparked this project. After I finished my first book, I was planning on writing on a different project. But then in 2016, the LDS Church published these minutes from the Council of 50, this organization that I'd mentioned before. These minutes had been restricted from historians ever since the moment of their creation. In fact, one of Joseph Smith's last commands before he was taken off to jail was ordering the secretary of that council to burn those minutes, and thankfully he didn't. But they remained sequestered, and church leaders, knowing the salacious nature of their contents, did not let anyone see them for over 170 years until they were published in 2016. And when they were published, I just looked at them and I saw immediately that there's a broader story there, and I was excited. But those weren't the only new documents that the LDS Church released. Over the last decade, the LDS Church has taken a much more transparent and progressive view on granting records to historians. And as a result of that, and as a result of the great work being done by the Joseph Smith Papers Project, who have continued to produce excellent scholarship and building relationship with LDS Church leaders to allow them access to more documents, as a result, we have hundreds of documents that if I were writing this just a couple decades ago, I might not have even known existed, which in the first place is what allowed this project to happen.
Hmm. Wow. So what was the decision?
Sorry, go ahead, David.
Yeah,
go
I was
ahead,
just
David.
Curious, what was the decision-making process for the church deciding to open up its archives publicly in this way?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think to a degree it was a generational turnover, that you have a lot of leaders in the LDS faith who are a lot not as wedded to old, less transparent practices, and instead are willing to open it up to historians. I think you also have this impact of all these great scholars who work for the LDS Church in Salt Lake City, who have been building a foundation of solid work and building good relationships with church leaders, to where church leaders may not feel comfortable letting it out into the general public, but once they see what the Joseph Smith Papers Project people are doing, they're a bit more comfortable that, you know, everything's not going to fall apart if we give access to these sources. And so I think you get both a natural progression of church leadership, but also the fruits of decades of works that have been done by LDS historians.
So one of the things that I think that Nauvoo is I guess known for is the place where polygamy gets introduced. Can you talk and one of the other things that's interesting I think about your book is the way you deal with gender and gender power dynamics and in the ways in which that's related to the introduction of polygamy. Can you talk about sort of how you decide to approach that in the book? Because obviously that's one of the things that people are going to jump towards when they think about what's happening in Nauvoo.
Absolutely. It's definitely the most scandalous, controversial aspect of early Mormonism and draws the most attention with good reason. But what stood out to me when I looked at the literature on Nauvoo is that you typically have all the work that's done on Nauvoo, on politics, on Joseph Smith, and then in a separate category, you have all the work done on polygamy. And this work done on polygamy is often done in a silo, in a vacuum that doesn't seem to be connected. And so I try to do a couple of things with my polygamy coverage of the book. First and foremost, I tried to show that it was connected to everything else going on in Nauvoo, that you can't really understand what's going on in the political sphere without understanding what's going on in the domestic sphere. And in fact, those two spheres kind of merge together. And I also try to highlight the roles of people who are participating in polygamy, especially the women, that rather than just seeing as a patriarchal institution that's deposited from top down by Joseph Smith, instead, I want to see how women are formulating the practice, how they're responding, how they're appropriating it. So I try to recover their voices as well. And in general, I try to show that polygamy was not something that was just kind of created in 1840, 1841, and then just existed the same until Joseph Smith's death. I tried to show that it evolved, and it evolved in ways that are both responding to circumstances taking place in Nauvoo, but also evolved in ways that were reflective of the broader United States. I tried to place these polygamous ideas and practice in the context of a period of American history where you see lots of innovation, lots of challenges to the traditional domestic hearth. And so polygamy in the end is something that's integrated. It's something that is collaborative with lots of people, and it's connected to these broader cultural currents taking place in the nation.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the real strengths of the book, Ben, and there are many, is the fact that you speak to the particularity of Nauvoo and this moment in Mormon history, but also connect it to the broader culture. So as your answer on gender reflects, that real strength of the book. And so I think the book works on so many levels. It's Western history. It's about the urban history of it's about urbanization in the antebellum period and how rapidly that's happening in the West. It's about migration. It's about church-state relations. I think it really makes a powerful intervention in the history of church-state relations, and I think it really works well. And congratulations on this, because you talk about it's a two-way street, you know. So it's about the impact of the state on people who are seeking to practice their faith, but it's also about what happens when a particular faith, you know, becomes a theocracy and takes over or seeks to appropriate state power. I think it really has a lot to contribute. Elaborate on that, because I imagine that might be one of the more controversial aspects of it in contemporary terms, because church-state relations continue to bedevil us.
Right. Thanks. And thanks for all those compliments, Frank. Your check is in the mail. For me, what stood out to me about the church-state relations and how unanswered a lot of the questions in Church of America. The Mormons felt free to do a lot of these because there weren't firm answers around them. I mean, by the 1840s America, democracy and disestablishment was still an experiment. I think just before when Alexis de Tocqueville tours America, there you get the European perspective on America and my education coming in. Alexis de Tocqueville says, the way to operate Christianity within a democratic society remains the biggest question that modern Americans are going to have to address. How do we balance, on the one hand, this fundamental belief that's shared by many in America that religion is crucial to civilization, to the problem that the government now seems to be trying to get out of the religion question altogether, which leads a lot of issues. For instance, what happens when there's a crazy religion that's going to threaten to decivilize our culture? That's what Mormonism represented to them. I mean, in olden times, the state could just step in and say, no, you're a crazy religion. We don't allow you at the table, and we're going to, you know, punish you accordingly. But in a nation where religious freedom is granted, what stakes do you, or what tools do you have at your disposal? The Mormons try to use this at their disposal. They say they're practicing their rights as a religious group to exercise their political vote as a bloc, to have their prophet dictate what's best for their community. And they say this isn't an infringement on religious liberty because we're consciously choosing to follow this prophet and follow his directives. But outside of Nauvoo, they're saying this is the very type of thing that we thought disestablishment was cutting away, that these political leaders and religious leaders aren't going to work in tandem anymore. And as a result, Nauvoo is a threat, because democracy, even outside of Nauvoo, democracy is seen as a fragile enterprise. And if someone like the Mormons come along, they can upend the whole establishment. And so I think when it comes to church and state power, we see both the radical nature of the Mormons' proposal, but also the fragile response, at least in the eyes of those outside of Nauvoo, of how do we handle such a dangerous threat?
Yes, and I'm trying to think of the right way to articulate this question. Did the who managed this better? Did Joseph Smith and his supporters who managed this question better? I mean, they clearly made a mess of it on both sides.
Yeah,
and we're not about ascribing blame in the past necessarily.
Right.
But this is a very complicated situation.
Right.
Could it have played out differently? Could people have been more reasonable?
Absolutely, it could have played out reasonably. And I do think that a lot of the when writing this book, I came to two conclusions. One, I was convinced that I just sympathized with the poor Mormons at their response. I worried that what they were doing, that what was happening to them was really framing what their experience. And I really felt bad for them. And I see their actions as actions out of desperation. So I sympathize with them. However, at the same time, my other decisions on how to respond only raised more problems. So I was drawn on. They felt that the democratic system had failed them, but at the same time, their solutions weren't making things any better. Now, I'll add another conclusion, perhaps the biggest irony that came to me as doing this project. Was that the mob that killed Joseph Smith, they too, ironically, came to the same perspective as Joseph Smith and the Mormons, that the democratic experiment was too fragile. And when they killed Joseph Smith as a mob in cold blood while he was held as a prisoner of the state in a county jail, that was an expression of their disbelief that the democratic system was going to work. To them, they saw politicians cozy up to the Mormons, a judicial system appear too malleable. The entire operation is something that could be fixed by those who, like the Mormons, might not have their best interests at heart. So as a result, that's why I call this book a study of democracy in crisis, because both sides of this divide came to the same conclusion that democracy was too fragile and they had to find other solutions.
But we're less than a decade into, and I'm using air quotes here, universal manhood suffrage. So America is supposed to be democratizing at this point, and it's already in crisis.
Right, absolutely, which tells us a lot about what this establishment meant, that to them it was uncertain. In 2020, we take for granted that democracy is the best avenue, the best solution. No matter how divided we may be, we agree, or at least we should agree, that turning the voice of the people is the best solution. But even a decade after universal manhood suffrage, I mean, there's a question of, can we trust all men to vote? What happens when they're crazy and following a heretical leader and they're following this fraudulent tyrant? Should they be allowed to vote? So at the very start, the Mormons are already questionable. And then you have the prophet telling them what to do. Well, that's a betrayal of the personal conscience. And that's, again, another major threat against our democratic system.
Luckily, these aren't issues we have to deal with today. So, David, I have a question for you. As a historian of the Civil War, so the period immediately after this, how does your reading of Ben's work and change your understanding of the period you work on and the material you deal with?
Well, so, I mean, one of the claims that Ben makes in the book, I think it's really an intriguing claim, is that, you know, Nauvoo is this extraordinary settlement on the frontier that is successful for a very brief window and then collapses. But then, you know, it culminates in the migration to Utah, which you frame as a kind of secession, you know, and thinking about what it means to be part of the United States in the 19th century and what it means to decide not to be part of the United States in the 19th century. I thought that was a really interesting sort of framework for how to think about how sort of tenuous the American democracy was in the mid-19th century and how people were both interested in participating in American democracy, but also when it didn't fit their needs or didn't feel like they were part of it, that they wanted to abandon that to establish a new frontier on the west or in the south, depending on how you want to frame that. I thought that was an interesting way to think about Mormon history, which is very different than I think how most people think about it.
Right, and if I could add to that really quick, sure. Too, one thing that stood out to me as I dabble into the Civil War era is these debates over federal sovereignty and federalism and states' rights that really were at the heart of the Nauvoo story, most specifically that when Joseph Smith decides that state and national politicians are no longer going to listen to them and respect their interests, and they decide to run Joseph Smith for the presidency, one of his platforms was to strengthen the federal government, to argue that to preserve the rights of minority groups and all citizens, the federal government must be willing and able to step in and protect their liberties, an argument that was quite rare at the time, but becomes more common during the Civil War era, and of course becomes one of the major driving forces between the Reconstruction Amendments. And so what I found striking about the Nauvoo story was in some ways the prescient nature of the Mormon arguments for federal control that don't come around until the Civil War era, but perhaps more ironically, arguments that the Mormons themselves leave behind when they move out to Utah and they tell the federal government, leave us alone, we want our own territorial sovereignty.
And one of the things I think people forget, or maybe it's a story we just don't teach because it doesn't seem like it's as organic to the narrative we're getting to, is that the Republican Party, you know, we talk about the Republican Party's opposition to the spread of slavery in the West, they were also pretty hostile to the Mormons, you know, in their platform in 1856 and 1860. You know, that's not a story I think it's told very much, especially considering the ways in which the politics of today works.
Yep, they were against the twin relics of barbarism, slavery and polygamy.
Yeah. which is, you know, that framework, which I think, you know, people are interested in the history of the Mormon Church are familiar with, but I don't think, you know, it's not necessarily part of the way we teach the coming of the Civil War, what the Republican Party means in its inception.
Right.
Why? I mean, I think this is a really great book in telling this story, which may be familiar to many Mormons to a sort of broader audience. Why do you think so many Americans are so profoundly ignorant of Mormon history? Because it seems like it's really a one of the more interesting stories in all of American history, and it typifies lots of the things that are going on in the mid-19th century about, you know, questions about religious innovation and westward expansion. It's got all of those big themes in it, and obviously all the political themes we've been talking about today.
Right.
Why is it that outside of the church itself, you know, most Americans know relatively little of this story?
Yeah, I think from the very start, Mormons have always been kind of otherized in the American culture, seen as those outside the American mainstream. Even when in the 20th century, Mormons did all they could to be assimilated into American culture and to be seen as the American religion, embracing Boy Scouts, being seen with their white shirts and ties, and being known as patriotic.
Sure.
Still, I think Mormons are kind of kept at arm's length. For a number of reasons, but one of those is I think they highlight some paradoxes of religiosity that Americans just aren't comfortable with. That religion is something that's firmly established, it's rational, it's something that, you know, civilized people do, and Mormon religion is just kind of seen as this irrational. And I think one of the elements of that was captured perfectly with Charles Dickens, who said that the Mormons had the gall to believe in angels in the age of railways, meaning that because the Mormon story is so recent, rather than of ancient vintage, because the story is so recent, it's seen as heretical, and it raises these questions of religious innovation that Americans just aren't comfortable with. And to embrace Mormons as part of the American story is to let a bit of irrationality into the American story, which, of course, that perspective ignores large swaths of American religious history. But in general, I think you see a firm resistance of allowing Mormons to become too central. Rather, we want Mormons on the stage dancing, singing, but not participating in the American narrative. And that's one of the things that my book tries to overcome.
Ben, what was the biggest challenge you faced in writing the book?
Yeah, the biggest challenge I face, there's a practical problem of keeping everything under 100,000 words, which is what I tried to do, and I failed. There's just so much of the story to tell. But I think the biggest challenge that I tried to do was mixing both narrative, what I knew was going to pull in a lot of general readers, but also historical context to be able to say why this story matters, and trying to find a balance between both character development and plot suspense, as well as talking about frontier expansion and party politics in the 1840s. And so interweaving those things was probably the biggest challenge for me.
Well, I think you did a great job surmounting those challenges, so congratulations.
Well, thank you.
what happened? So tell us about your book tour, which, of course, got caught up in this other world historical moment that has unfolded over the past few weeks.
Yeah, I feel like I'm so lucky that I was able to produce a book and have a good publishing team that enabled me to have one of these book tours that I'd long dreamt about. It was going to be 10 weeks long with visiting lots of different universities and bookstores. And then the 10-week tour ended up being a 3-week tour. And I knew that the chances were high. As I set out for my first trip, this was in late February. So, of course, news was starting to spread about the virus, although the government wasn't taking it that seriously, spoiler alert, at that point. And then after I finished my second week, I knew things were going to be bad. And then my third week was filled with lots of ironies to where, for instance, I was lecturing at UC Santa Barbara. And an hour before my lecture, there was a university-wide email at Santa Barbara saying the campus was being shut down the next day. So in a real way, Mormon Nauvoo shut down UC Santa Barbara as the last public event. And then, you know, a lot of universities were very sorry that they had to cancel the invitations due to the pandemic, which I fully understood. We're going to hopefully reschedule for the next year, but who knows what budgets are going to be like the next year. So I'm, you know, thinking positively, but also planning realistically. But it has led me to do a lot more digital stuff. I've done things like a Reddit AMA, which I know David did recently as well. I've done a number of digital book clubs. I'm participating in tomorrow. There's going to be what's called tomorrow is Saturday, April 25th. And There's going to be a history book summit put on by Lindsay Stravinsky, a wonderful scholar who put together this great digital summit where there's going to be, I don't know, 24 authors talking about their new books in short 10 to 15 minute videos and then answering questions over Twitter. So it's definitely making us be a lot more innovative in how to reach audiences in a time when audiences physically can't gather together.
Well, and you're a very successful kind of user of social media, in my observation. If you don't follow Ben, you should, on Twitter and various other platforms. But as you know, Twitter, for example, is such a reasonable place of reasoned discourse. and the fact that you work on a topic that, if misconstrued, could be controversial, at least both to both Mormons and non-Mormons, I'm sure that all your interactions have been incredibly positive and uplifting.
Absolutely. No, you're right. It's such a broad range. But I'll tell you, Frank, I love the Twitter sphere because I've learned to embrace the block button. Right. And I'm very happy to talk with people who have issues with my book. And I know there are problems in the book. I'm far from perfect, and the book is far from perfect, and there are real things that deserve criticism. But I also know that there's segments of people on Twitter who proudly follow our Twitterer-in-chief, who uses it as his disposal to, you know, not do productive dialogue. And I'm very happy to block them. So in reality, a majority of my Twitter interaction are great dialogues. And I've just found Twitter and social media to be, as long as you know how to moderate discussion, as long as you're not afraid to just block the trolls, I'm able to communicate with readers. I'm able to communicate with fellow scholars in ways that wouldn't be possible otherwise.
That's excellent. And you're doing, I guess, more of that in lieu of the it's a virtual book tour now rather than an actual book tour, I suppose.
Yeah, it is. And I even have a designated Zoom room in where I go and have these Zoom book club meetings. Although, as listeners can probably already tell, I can get a bit too energetic. So my family has put a moratorium on doing book group discussions after 9 p.m.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I think that's all I had for questions, David. Have we got through your list?
We got about all the things I want to talk about. I just want to congratulate you again. This is really an amazing book, and I'm really sorry that the book tour got cut short. But if at any point in the next little bit you find yourself on this side of the Atlantic, we can add an Edinburgh stop to the tour and
It's always been a dream to return to Edinburgh. Yeah, it's always been a dream to return to Edinburgh, my favorite European city.
You're always welcome.
Bring the family, we'll make it happen.
Right. I think that probably does us for this week. Thank you so much, Ben. It was great to connect with you as always. Great to see you, albeit virtually. I hope you and your family remain well, as the same for you too, David. But yes. In the meantime, you know, good luck with the History Summit tomorrow.
Yes,
and good
Thank
luck
you.
With the book.
It's been a great honor to be on with you guys.
Until Pleasure. Then, Frank. Cheers.
Yep. Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.